go away.
1756. A cat walked into a bar.
God, do you want to hit a dude?
I'll do one buck.
People say this is funny.
Not Gary Gera.
It's Dave O'Kay.
Someone or something is tickling people.
Is it for fun?
And this is not going to become a tickling podcast.
Okay.
You're listening to The Vollop, an occasional sicko serial killer podcast in which I, being a 007, read a true story to my friends,
Varley
and Greg,
who have no idea what the topic is going to be about.
Okay, listeners, Vassals of Kingsgrave, this is an unusual format for a podcast in which we pay homage to a podcast that we all love listening to called The Dollop with Dave, Anthony, and Gareth. What's his surname?
Reynolds.
And Gareth Reynolds.
And it's Gary.
In which Dave basically gives a overview of a topic from American history, usually, and then Gareth just doesn't know what the hell's going on and has to comment on it with some good humour. So we're going to do that today because we love The Dollop. Apparently we all started listening to it because Claudius the Fool started listening. He is the ur-listener, not Matt, just to clarify that.
You can have that, it's fine.
I never thought to be.
No, it's fine. I'm happy to share The Dollop with the world.
Exactly.
You know, I'm pretty sure it's like Dave and Gareth are happy to share it with the world.
Yes. But little dollop history, I think The Dollop only started because Dave used to have this podcast with Greg Barrett, the comedian, called Walk in the Room, and then Greg got addicted to dog pills and Dave had nothing to do, so he had to start to do his own thing. I'm pretty sure that's... I remember listening to that back
in
the day.
Wait. But, he got addicted to dog pills?
Go listen to Walk in the Room. It's
bury like the headline.
Go listen to Walk in the Room. There's 200 episodes. It's great. You can see all the seeds of what became The Dollop. And it's just an awesome podcast on its own.
He got addicted to dog pills?
Yeah, he got addicted to dog pills. How's that? Does that not happen in your life?
I mean,
never done some special
I don't like talking about other people's substance abuse issues, but he owns it and he's past it.
What chain of events leads you to eat a pill designed for a dog?
I believe you have
wanting to get fucked up and having a
episode
dog.
Episode 186, probably.
Okay, cool. So basically, the topic today is a very serious and dark one. And in normal Vox style, we would do this very respectfully. So I just want to emphasize that there is some underlying respect for this topic, but in line with the style of The Dollop, this is going to be done with some humor. So just to get that out of the way. Right. Oh, I wanted to do this for so long. 1899!
All right.
Sounded so good. Felt so good. Okay. 1899, England. On the 8th of April, John Reginald Halliday Christie was born into...
Oh, that's a great English name.
Was born into a low...
Halliday?
Christie was born into a lower middle-class family in Halifax, Northern England, the sixth of seven children. Both parents appeared to have been stern, almost Victorian pillars of the community, and John was raised to be a church-going Boy Scout, first aider, and keen footballer. In 1911, the 11-year-old John was taken to see the dead body of his maternal grandfather laid out in the parlour. He recalls...
Why?
Yeah, apparently this was norms, like the dead body of the relative would come home, would be laid out in state in the parlor, and people would come see it.
For how long? That shit's got to start to stink, right?
But they're Catholics, right? So between the death and the funeral, then people can like say prayers and stuff and weirdness, I guess.
Are they Catholics? They're English.
Yeah, there's Catholics in England, particularly in Northern England.
They didn't kill all the Catholics. They just took all their shit.
Oh.
Actually, maybe he isn't Catholic. I don't know, but this is what happened. Him being Catholic is not in my notes, ignore that bit. Okay, so anyway, he's looking at the grandfather laid out in the parlour. He recalls feeling no fear, only a morbid fascination.
Oh boy.
Did it feel like, you know, like a sneeze almost better, only better?
So at the age of 12, he began sneaking into a local cemetery to look into the children's vault at the small baby coffins.
Excuse me?
Yes, that's what he
looked
did.
Into the small
sure
baby coffins.
Like...
Yeah. In his latest...
Hey, Billy, what you doing tonight? Going to look at the small baby coffins? What you doing?
Going to the cinema?
Playing baseball?
Please explain children's vault. Is that like every cemetery or is that an English thing? A children's vault? Like this is where the kids are? They're separate?
I have absolutely no idea. I've never heard of that before, but apparently that was a thing in Halifax. Oh. It's Yorkshire. It's a weird part of the country. It's a dark country. In his later teenage years, a second formative experience occurred. Having failed to attract a girlfriend when his peers were already sexually active.
I knew it was going to be a sex thing. I knew it was going to be a sex thing.
This is not going to be good.
John eventually dated a young girl who worked in a mill. She was apparently rather forward. When he couldn't perform sexually with her, she mocked him and spread humiliating rumours through town. Among his nicknames were Can't Do It Christy and No Dick Reggie.
Excuse me? No Dick Reggie?
Yeah, his name is John Reginald Halliday Christie, and actually most of his mates called him Reg. So it was No Dick Reggie or Can't Do It Christie.
Can't Do It Christie, huh? Pretty on the nose there.
Yeah, and those are the polite nicknames that get put into the serial killer books, right?
Yeah, was his response like, I had too much to drink. Like, you know, it was the booze. She's really ugly.
Exactly.
Something.
So anyway, this manifests itself into a fear of women and being mocked by women, which is never a good thing. So anyway, by this time...
Should we go back to the children coffins?
Yes, please do.
Oh, no.
I think we should move on.
I don't like the thought of him going back to the children's coffins, maybe. Okay,
anyway, so by this time, he'd left school age 14, because that was normal apparently then, and gone to work as a cinema projectionist. He would take a visit to prostitutes in 1917 for him to lose his virginity, by which point he was 18 on active service in World War One. He was soon...
That's decent. I mean, 18's a good age, right?
Yeah,
that's
but not... to a prostitute, though. Well, in the army.
I mean, you all got to pay for it somehow.
Doesn't England have a long history of, like, rich lords taking their sons to prostitutes to lose their virginity? I feel like that's a thing. I'm not making that up.
I feel like that's a thing regardless of country, no? But he's not a rich lord. I mean, he's definitely a sort of middle class, low middle class guy. Okay,
come here, son. We're gonna get you laid and maybe syphilis.
Yeah, I think that's more a wartime thing, no?
Yeah.
So anyway, he's on active service in World War One, but he was soon invalided out for a mustard gas poisoning and was demobbed in 1919, after which he went back to cinema work in Halifax. He claimed he couldn't speak for 3 years due to mustard damage. But it's really unlikely that this was the case because he was basically courting and married his wife Ethel during this time. But he did, however, speak very softly for the rest of his life. So it's quite interesting that he always suffers from illnesses but seems to exaggerate just how bad they are.
And then was his nickname like Reggie Whispers or something? Like, did he get a new name?
Which is definitely an upgrade on No Dick Reggie. Sort of No Tongue Reggie.
No Dick Reggie Whispers. It's an extension.
Exactly. Okay, so basically he meets his wife Ethel, who's a local girl, in 1920. The marriage seemed happy, but John, an admittedly unreliable witness, later stated he had trouble having sex. She had one miscarriage, and although they didn't use contraception after that, they never had any children.
Wait, this is some guy named John said they had trouble having sex?
Oh, that is him, John Reginald Christie.
Oh, sorry. I thought it was somebody else.
I'll call him Christie from now on. That'll probably make it easier.
Okay. It was Johnny Limpick.
Yeah, exactly. So he's out of the army in 1919. He gets married in 1920. And his criminal record begins in 1921. So he's 22 at this point. He's convicted of stealing postal orders because he has a new job as a postman. So he's basically stealing checks and cash from the post. Despite the high value of the money stolen, he was only sentenced to 3 months without hard labor because of his previous good character. 2 years later, John was convicted of skipping out on a bill at a bed and breakfast hotel, but was only put on 12 months probation. He then left Halifax, alleging that his wife had had an affair, which has never really been proven.
Did he leave with his, or did his wife stay there, or did they never find the wife, or are we getting to that?
We're getting to that, but he basically just skips out of town, effectively. So the next 10 years...
He's like, there goes Johnny Limpick.
Yeah, Johnny Limpick, but you know, they're not having sex anyway, and she's apparently shagging some guy at work, so...
Well, you know, she's got to get hers somewhere.
Exactly.
No, she doesn't. This is 1906. She doesn't have... That didn't happen
until... It's 1923! 23, even better.
Exactly.
Women are voting. They're, you know, they're in charge.
Are women voting? Jazz age. Women might be voting.
1920. Well, America.
In America.
Yeah.
Most civilized countries.
Uh-huh. I love how, like, he could still be, like, sentenced to hard labor as well.
Yeah, right.
Do they still have debtors' prisons at this point? Or
probably.
The workhouses?
No, not workhouses, I wouldn't have thought, but maybe debtors' prisons. I don't know.
I should bring that back. Sorry.
They basically have.
It's called prison.
Yeah,
it's called the mortgage. Exactly. Yeah. The next 10 years saw Christie leading a hand-to-mouth existence in London, committing petty theft of cash and a bicycle. After all, he stole cash and he stole a bike.
Oh, so he stole them. He didn't steal cash like while on a bike.
No,
as in, like, a...
no, this was a separate crime.
So he mugged someone for their bicycle.
Yeah, and then tried to fence it and was caught. After all, okay. These were the Depression years, and his criminal record would have made it harder to find work. He was sentenced to short prison stints in 1923, 1929, and 1933. Now, here it gets interesting. The second...
Wait a minute. So, I mean, I know in America, like, it was hard for men to find work, but I thought, like, England was pretty decimated from World War I and the Spanish Influenza, like, that their workforce was still pretty, like, able-bodied men were okay.
Yeah, no, but you still, the Depression was still very bad, no?
I don't know. Yeah. It was here. Yeah. But we're huge.
So there you go.
Okay.
The second of these prison stints was for Christie's first violent crime. So this is all a bit shady. He was apparently living with a woman called Mrs. Maud Cole and her son, unnamed. Some have said that Mrs. Cole was a prostitute, but there's no real evidence for it. But evidently she was earning the money and he sponged off her and she started nagging him. And he took her son's cricket bat and whacked her over the head while she was sitting down at the table. He caused a 5-inch gash in the back of her head that was spurting blood and had to be stitched up by a surgeon. And then basically jumped out of the window. The neighbor came, he kind of like bashed her in the back of the head with the cricket bat, then jumped out of the kitchen window and escaped. The neighbor came in and found her. She was then taken to hospital.
I fell down the stairs.
He later visited her in prison and claimed it was an accident. He said he was just testing the cricket bat by swinging it and didn't realize he was going to hit the back of her head.
I was just throwing punches and she just got in the way. It wasn't my fault.
Apparently Mrs. Maud Cole did not believe this and neither did the judge.
Why?
Okay. So during 1923 to 1933, Christie's abandoned wife Ethel stayed with her family and started seeing another man who wanted at one time to marry her. But as she couldn't get pregnant, he left her. At this point, she came to London to visit her husband in prison. And when he got out, they moved to Notting Hill, West London, which was then far from the fashionable area it has since become. So some people have described it as the Whitechapel of West London. So it was very much just a place of not explicit slums, but certainly very ramshackle housing for working class people who are renting and living very sort of hand-to-mouth existences.
Isn't that where a lot of Jack the Ripper's victims were, Whitechapel?
Yeah, so that people are describing it as the Whitechapel of the West. I mean, it's certainly not that bad, but it's not great. It's definitely a very dodgy area.
Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts.
Yeah, I was waiting for someone to make a Notting Hill reference.
Yeah, but basically up until even my lifetime, I mean, it was a really dodgy area, and then suddenly it all got cleaned up in the 90s and is now stupidly expensive.
Yeah, because it gets gentrified. Welcome to like Boston.
Exactly.
The artists and the gays move in and all of a sudden like bad neighborhoods are awesome.
Exactly. Wait,
artists and the gays? Those are two separate groups? What are you talking about?
You know, I mean, not distinctly separate, but yeah, I mean, typically like the poors and like the people with culture move in and all of a sudden like everyone's all pissed off and rents go up and property taxes and...
It all goes to shit. In 1937, Mr. and Mrs. Christie moved into the now notorious small terraced house, 10 Rillington Place. The house...
Is it notorious?
Why is it notorious?
Well, it is actually in England, I think it is. You guys probably isn't. In 1937, they moved into the now notorious small terraced house, 10 Rillington Place. The house had no bathroom and only one outdoor lavatory. The kitchen was tiny and each of the three floors was rented by a different family. So I want to just point out this is 1937 and there's no bathroom in this apparent house.
And his new name was Reggie Holds His Shit.
But the Christies seemed to live a banal existence. He was a cinema projectionist in Hammersmith and they bought a dog and a cat.
A Hammersmith?
In Hammersmith. Hammersmith's a part of London, so it's a little bit west of Notting Hill. But anyway, he just works in a cinema, so that's the kind of the three line.
So at this point, he's just a dude with a cat and a dog and a wife, and
he's like 38, yeah.
One lady.
He's 38 years old, and he's got some petty crime, and he's obviously bashed a potential prostitute in the back of the head with a cricket bat.
Well, I mean, it's been well established that she put her head in the way of the cricket bat.
Yeah, he was just testing it for swing, but you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. And he keeps on roping it into whatever woman he's married to, and they keep on trying to have a kid.
Yeah. So you know they're still having sex occasionally, but yeah, she's not getting pregnant. So World War II breaks out. Christie, now aged 40, is just on the cusp of being too old to be enlisted. So he becomes, and bear in mind, he's already served 3 terms in prison at this point, an Army Reserve policeman.
Sounds about right.
The country was apparently in such desperate need for manpower that apparently his record wasn't checked.
Okay.
Well, has he been convicted of any, like, these are small crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, but bashing the woman in the back of the head is grievous bodily harm, so I mean...
But that, he wasn't convicted, that was, she, like, dropped charges, right?
No, he was convicted for all three and served time for all three, for the three, okay. for the two robberies and that, yeah. He did, I think he did 12 months with hard labor for that second one, so yeah. He's got a proper criminal record. Yeah.
Nazis are invading, so, you know, it's all hands on deck.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, all the young men have gone to war, you have to sort of lower your standards somewhat. He apparently loved his power, and although he hadn't contacted his family since 1923, he did send his dear old mum a picture of himself in uniform. He also used his power to basically turn a blind eye to prostitution in exchange for being able to use the prostitutes. And while he was also sleeping with the prostitutes, he had an affair with a colleague called Gladys Jones. He also continued his career of feigning or exaggerating minor illnesses to get time of work, giving him an apparent facility with medical language.
So, wait a minute. So, I mean, is he really fake? Like, what diseases is he making up? I'm guessing, like, after you get mustard gassed, like, you probably have some, like, residual, you know, respiratory effects.
Yeah, I mean, he claims that he went blind from the mustard gas and that he genuinely couldn't speak for 3 years. And I think that there probably is an element in which he was affected, certainly in speech. He definitely did not turn blind. But he claims things like... sort of diseases of the stomach, and he's always, like, in 1942 he had 8 months off work because he needs the time to do his other stuff that we'll get to.
I feel like we're getting to something where now he's learning medical stuff and medical knowledge. Like, I can't imagine where this is going, but please take us there.
Okay, so we're about to get to the good stuff. So the war has started. It's now 3 years later. It's 1942. And Christie meets a 21-year-old Austrian woman called Ruth First. Now, I mean, a lot of these...
Wait a minute, what?
Ruth First. She's, or F-U-E-R-S-T, First.
Why is there an Austrian woman in England during the World War II?
Hashtag not all Germans, Matt. Jeez.
Jesus, okay. Ooh. Ruth First, this 21-year-old, is actually a really tragic case. She was a Mischling by Nazi standards, so mixed Jewish, and she'd fled to England before the war had broken out and was living, although, you know, she was well-educated, was doing sort of quite menial jobs. And then when the war broke out, she was put in an internment camp. She'd had an illegitimate child who was given up for adoption, and no one really knows what happened to that daughter. She then come out of the internment camp, was living in West London, couldn't really find work, had to, you know, she's one of these people, because you're an sort of enemy alien, she had to register with the government every week. And she ended up basically working as a prostitute in Ladbroke Grove, which is around that Notting Hill area. So, you know, she'd fled to England for her life and then basically was reduced to prostitution. So it's awfully sad. So at the age
hilarious.
And all that had happened by the age of 21. I know. So she came across Christie, who offered to help her out in a cafe in Ladbroke Grove. So this is sort of pattern, like he pretends to be a nice, avuncular character. She went with him to 10 Rillington Place on April 21st, 1943, at lunchtime. The wife, Ethel, was out. She and Christie had sex, whether for money is unclear, but probably. And as they had sex, he spontaneously strangled her to death. He said of her, and I quote, "She looked more beautiful in death than in life. I remember as I gazed down at the still form of my first victim, experiencing a strange, peaceful thrill. It was thrilling because I had embarked upon the career I had chosen for myself, the career of a murderer," end quote.
All right. Well, that's fucking awful.
Yeah. 21.
This means he was caught at some point and had time to write his memoirs, apparently.
Yeah.
When his guidance counselor told him, like, "Oh, you're going to be a..." He's like, no, I'm going to be a murderer and I'm going to choke people out. Yeah. So this is a little much.
Christie wrapped Ruth's body in her coat and hid her under the floorboards in the front room of his house, where his brother-in-law was sleeping that night. The next day, he took the body to the back garden, washed it, and buried it in the garden and burned the clothes. Ruth was reported missing very quickly by her landlady, but as she had no friends or family in London, had lived at 14 addresses in the last 4 years, no suspicion was involved. The missing person's report wasn't followed up. So she was just one of these people with no one to care for her missing.
Nobody but her landlord, because she
who's like, "Where's my rent there?"
Yeah, exactly. And that's like a theme that's going to emerge as well. Like the landlady is always the first person to report you missing.
So meanwhile, isn't the government supposed to be tracking her because she's a resident alien of like a, you know.
Yeah, but when she goes missing and if she has no friends or family to follow up with, I mean, what are they going to do?
Yeah,
I mean,
they're invading, you know, Africa and Italy at this point. So they're not really checking up on the whereabouts of one Austrian prostitute.
I mean, bear in mind, they're so short of manpower. They have hired as a policeman a man who's been convicted 3 times and served prison time. So this isn't the cutting edge of policing in London right now.
All right.
Anyway, it gets better. So after the murder, but perhaps by coincidence due to ill health, Christie quit the police force and became a driver for a radio company. It was here that he met a radio company. Like it was called, I think it was called Ultimate Electric or Ultra Electric, and it made radios. So he was just a driver. It was here that he met his second victim, 31-year-old Muriel Edie. So Muriel was from Plaistow, which is East London, but her mother's early death and her father's job as a merchant seaman meant that she was brought... Pause for Matt to smirk. Yes, a merchant seaman meant she was brought up by paid helpers and lived a peripatetic existence.
Peripatetic is one of my favorite words. I'm so happy you brought it up.
I don't know what that means.
Matt, what does peripatetic mean?
I just said I don't know what it means.
I know, I saw it. It means like always traveling and never set in one spot, like constantly moving. Peripatetic.
Oh, like a Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we'll go with peripatetic.
Gathering no moss. Well,
I get it.
Rolling Stone.
Yeah. I mean, the key point is that, like Ruth first, she's a woman who maybe doesn't have that many people who care about where she is. So unlike the spontaneous murder of Ruth First, the murder of Muriel Edie was carefully planned. She was concerned that she suffered from bronchitis and had a lot of catarrh, and because Christie had suffered from so many ailments, he was able to sound confident in diagnosing a cure. He faked bronchitis, took time off work, invited her around his flat, and claimed to have created a kind of inhaler. He'd actually hooked up the gas mains running through a pipe via some perfumed water and into another pipe that Edie inhaled. She passed out from carbon monoxide. Yeah. So he has
he's read some books. He left out the part where he went to the library and was like, excuse me, do you have a section on poisoning people with gas masks? No. Okay, right over here.
He just had a pipe go through two glass jars. Basically,
and this woman just put her mouth on like a pipe and was like, oh yeah, well, this will cure my bronchitis, my fake bronchitis.
Well, you've got to understand that he's obviously very, very charismatic and basically can persuade people that he knows about stuff and can fix their ailments. So anyway, this woman passes out from carbon monoxide poisoning. Christie then has sex with her multiple times. He strangles her, has sex with her while she dies, then wraps her body, buries her in the garden next to Ruth. This was October the 7th, 1944. She wasn't reported missing for a week, and it was assumed that she died in a bombing of a dance hall in Putney. So I think you've got to
remember... Sorry, by the Germans or by...
Yeah, I mean, you have to remember that London is being bombed at this point every single night in the Blitz. And that young girls with no family suddenly go missing, people just assume maybe they've died in the sort of pub bombing or whatever the night before.
So wartime is good for serial killers is what you're saying.
Wartime is good for serial killers because there's lots of people in town with no family, like displaced people. And also...
Like the World's Fair with H.H. Holmes.
Yeah, absolutely, like the World's Fair with H.H. Holmes. And because of that, although these are the only two murders that have been identified in wartime, there are suspicions that maybe he killed other women because, to a certain extent, how would you have known if you didn't find the body? Anyway, so far, the war is over.
I think Amber's here. I think Amber's here.
Hey, Amber. Is Amber making cat noises?
She didn't want to interrupt.
I'm whole day.
Hey, Amber.
I get it. This is so inside dollar baseball. It's not even.
Oh, feel free to chip in.
Amber, that's all.
People used to think my name was Gary growing up, just so you know. That's true.
Okay, carry on.
Wait a minute, you didn't know your own name?
No, I knew my name. People didn't.
People.
Ah.
And he got really, really angry and got an inferiority complex.
You like it? It's pound sign Greg.
Don't diagnose me, Bina.
Okay, so the second murder seemed to have satiated Christie. He carried on his affair with Gladys until her husband came home from the war in 1945 and got into a fist fight with him.
Wait, he's had an Edith and a Gladys so far?
So he's married to Edith,
I'm just guessing that Bertha is next.
I'll put $10 on Ruth.
Well, we already had a Ruth, but there's a barrel coming up.
barrel. There's a barrel coming up. Okay.
Okay. I'm glad you were happy, Greg. So anyway,
Evans is the only barrel I know, and that's from 1937. So.
Okay. So basically, he carried on his affair with Gladys until the husband comes home and punches him out. In 1946, the war's over, and he gets a job at the post office. Again, a job at the post office where he has been convicted of a crime of nicking cash and checks from the post office. But once again, no one checked his criminal record to know he'd been convicted.
He's given postman.
I feel like England really isn't trying. It may have its priorities elsewhere.
Yes, it may have
done. Yeah, like the war.
But the war's over at this point. This is 1946.
Well, okay, the rebuilding and the, you know, well, the shit they got to do. Clement Attlee's there, Churchill's kicked out. There's a lot of chaos going on.
Yeah, we've got rationing and all that shit. Okay. At this time,
that's the word. Rationing lasted till the mid-50s. I didn't know that.
Yeah, we were far worse off after the war than during the war in some respects.
That's why they printed so few copies of The Lord of the Rings, because there was still paper rationing in 1955.
Indeed.
The more you
boom.
And at this time...
And also...
Oh, sorry.
Sorry. No, I was going to say, the book that Greg gave me for advanced reading, Last Hope Island, goes into that a little bit.
There you go.
Also about how inept England was in general, and how the Slovakians and the Polish did more to help them than is really recognized.
The Polish basically cracked Enigma, right? So, yeah.
They not only stole Enigma, but they were like the best fighter pilots in the RAF.
Yeah, in the Battle of Britain, 100%. But we learned that
in some Americans. There were some Americans there too.
We do learn that in World War in history at school, though. So I don't know if it's overlooked. Okay, so basically this is also the time, 1946, where we have the first reported incident of Christie offering to help out a colleague with his wife who'd been pregnant and saying that he used to be a doctor, which is obviously a complete bracken lie, and that he can help her out with a backstreet abortion if they don't want to keep the baby.
He's like, I have an inhaler that you could use.
Yeah, the colleague refused his offer. So we now move forward a few years to 1948. Christie is now 49 years old. He's got 3 convictions, 1 for grievous bodily harm, has worked as a policeman and back in the post office. And a new couple move into 10 Rillington Place called Timothy and Beryl Evans. Timothy Evans was a 25-year-old working-class Welsh Catholic boy of little formal education. He had low IQ and apparently a mental age of 11 to 14.
Didn't I say Beryl Evans was someone I knew before?
Yes, you did.
Beryl Evans is the fictional name of the author of Charlie the Choo Choo from the Stephen King Dark Tower novels. I don't know if there's a connection there, but I am mentioning it. I meant to say Beryl Markham before, the famous aviatrix, but Beryl Evans was a...
See, I just thought you knew about the case and we're getting the...
No, I didn't. Beryl Evans was the name that Stephen King used to write Charlie the Choo Choo, which is like a fake kid's book. It's actually terrifying, but it is a children's book. But I was thinking of Beryl Markham, the aviator.
Okay. Well, Timothy and Beryl Evans are absolutely pivotal to this story, so that's a good name to... somehow intuitively get. So basically the husband, he's got a patchy employment record. He is an inveterate liar. Everyone agrees on this. He's been convicted, a bit like Christie, of petty crimes such as handling stolen goods and selling stolen watches. Timothy's new young wife was Beryl. She was 19 and already pregnant. The daughter Geraldine was born in 1949, and Beryl soon returned to work. Apparently, she flirted with a colleague, and Timothy slapped her and caused a scene at her workplace. There were lots of reports, actually, of violent arguments between the two, and the couple were increasingly in debt and had massive arguments about that fact. And
he was just swinging his arm, and she got in the way.
I know, shit happens, right?
I was just testing me arm. It's just testing me arm.
And by autumn 1949, Beryl was pregnant again. Woo. So she tries to take pills to get rid of the baby.
Tansy tea.
Greg, I think she had another vodka.
He's never had a kid at this point, right?
Yeah, the Christies have never had a kid, but they say, or he says, he can help out with abortions. And apparently Beryl does indeed want to abort her baby. So we're now getting...
Is he going back to children's coffins?
We're getting to the real meat of the story here. So what happened next is very controversial and contested. One version has the couple getting into a violent argument. Evans apparently then beats and strangles his wife, murders his child, wraps the bodies in a blanket and tablecloth, and hides them in the outdoor lavatory at 10 Rillington Place. This is in the garden where Christie has already buried 2 women.
This is the murder garden.
This is the murder garden. Apparently,
but also,
Evans...
Why is he hiding bodies in the only place anyone could take a shit in this building?
apparently he hides them kind of like underneath the wash basin. So yeah, it's slightly odd. He then tells her family that she's gone to Brighton and continues caring for the baby Geraldine for a few Brighton. Days before killing her too. So basically, the first theory is that the husband has gone into a violent argument with a wife over debt, has done her in, and then after a few days realizes he can't cope with the baby, kills her too, job done, out in the washhouse.
So actually, popped off to Brighton is kind of a nice euphemism for got her ass murdered.
Well, I don't think it's generally seen as a euphemism for that, but in this case, it certainly was.
No, I'm just saying it should be.
You know,
I live in Brighton.
If P ever puts on Facebook that I've gone to Brighton, be concerned.
And if you're not here.
Not for long, Matt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The second version of events is what Evans described in his first confessions. He handed himself in saying, and I quote, "I want to give myself up. I have disposed of my wife. I put her down the drain. I know what I am saying. I cannot sleep and want to get it off my chest. I will tell you all about it and you can write it down. I'm not very well educated and cannot read or write," end quote. In this version, Evans gets some abortion pills for his wife, but they kill her and he buries the body in a drain. But the police duly went to search the drain and found nothing. So that's version.
Sorry, so a drain is the sewer?
Yeah, the sewer outside the house.
Okay, it's not like the sink.
Yeah, so that's basically...
Wait, did you think sewer was like an English word for something else?
No, I just didn't know, like, he put her down the drain. It sounded like, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, but you can't literally put a woman down the drain in the sink.
You wouldn't think so, but, you know, with a trash compactor.
Come on, that day and age.
They didn't have a bathroom. They're not going to have a trash compactor, Matt. It's basic living.
That's fair.
She's got you there, buddy. Logic. Yeah.
Okay.
Fuck.
Okay, option number three of what happened. So Evans then switched to the third version of events in a second confession. And this is the one that's now seen as most likely. He says his original confession was merely to protect Christy, who botched an abortion, perhaps deliberately, and killed Beryl. A few days later, Christy told Evans that he'd found a couple from Acton who'd take the baby in. Evans said that he left the baby perfectly healthy in the pram and went to work and never saw his baby again, and that presumably Christy had killed her too. So those are your three options.
So basically what's going on here is what's going to happen with women's healthcare in the next couple of months in the United States.
Backstreet abortions.
Yeah.
Yeah, Planned Parenthood is very valuable for all sorts of reasons, but it stops women putting themselves in a vulnerable position. End of year.
I love that boy band from the 80s.
Huh?
Excuse me?
From the 90s. The 90s, right?
What?
The Backstreet abortions?
Backstreet
abortions. Oh, right.
We took it. We found the level.
All right.
Okay, so the murder investigation was certainly flawed. While the house and garden were searched, it was done in such a perfunctory way as not to uncover the two women's bodies. So they basically ransacked the outdoor lavatory, but didn't find the bodies in the garden, despite the fact that bones were apparently sticking up out of the ground, including a femur that was propping up part of a fence.
That's a load-bearing femur. You don't. That's been there for years.
That's just me bone garden, Governor. That's just me bone garden. Nothing to see here.
Meanwhile, everyone else in the building is like, "Where the fuck am I going to take a shit?"
It's just amazing to me that no one smells the body like under the sink. And I mean, that lavatory must have smelled so bad already of like old compacted shit that you couldn't smell a decomposing woman's body. But anyway. But what the police do find is they do find the bodies under the sink, because that's what Evans has told them, or where Evans has told them to look. The baby had been killed with a bow knot. Geraldine had been strangled.
A what?
A bow knot. Like a bow knot. When you tie a knot around the neck like a bow and then tighten it.
That's how I want to go.
So
donuts.
Yeah, I mean, he's got to look good, right?
How do you die with a donut?
Well, you eat one a day for 60 years and you eventually die of
Type 2 diabetes. And then okay, Geraldine had been strangled, although she'd also bled out from the quote-unquote abortion. The dead male fetus was still inside her, but there was no evidence of anyone having sex with her. This is very crucial as to whether the examiner actually looked or didn't look, and whether he therefore didn't find semen or, you know...
I assume he didn't look, because it's 1946.
No. They did routinely look. And actually, well, I'll get to it, but the guy who did the autopsy...
He's like, don't worry, it's emergency.
No, emergency. He definitely looked, and he said that this woman had not been sexually interfered with. So that just bear that in mind. Okay. So Evans has handed himself in. He's confessed, and then he's like double confessed and said, actually, he didn't do it, but Christy did it. On the 11th of January, 1950, the trial of Timothy Evans began. It attracted no attention. It was just seen as another bit of domestic violence. Christy was the principal witness for the prosecution.
What was their defense?
Christie's criminal record was exposed at the trial, as a result of which he lost his job, but the jury apparently thought he was a good man who'd gone astray in his youth but had turned out okay in the end. Christie apparently presented very well and was charismatic. His soft-spoken voice convinced the jury that he'd sustained injury as a war hero, and he played up on that for their sympathy.
He's like, I was just trying to put a bow tie on the kid, and all of a sudden he's dead.
No, well, he was blaming Evans, right? So he was testifying that Evans and his wife argued all the time, that he'd heard bumps in the night above when Evans was obviously strangling her to death, and that it was very unfortunate, but that's probably what had happened. Evans, on the other hand, who we know has a low IQ and a mental age of 14 maximum, was the only witness.
That's new information.
No, I told you that before. You were just probably drinking.
No, you said he was stupid, but you didn't say a mental age of 14.
Well, 11 to 14. And that's very interesting, because the point is, you know that Christie is very good at sort of manipulating people and coming across as gaining sympathy. So the question is, was he manipulating Evans, who had a mental age of 11 to 14?
Evans, she did say 11.
Yeah. Evans was the only witness for the defense, but it was easy to prove he was a liar, and his altered confession stood against him. At one point, the judge actually said to him, how are we supposed to believe you when you've changed your story? The entire trial only lasted 3 days, and the jury only took 40 minutes to convict Evans of murdering his daughter, because actually the trial was for murdering the daughter, not the wife. He was hanged at Pentonville Prison on March 9th. So,
14 minutes. Even 14 minutes. That's a little short.
Yeah. Well, a three-day trial for murder, right? I mean,
God damn it.
How long was the OJ deliberation? I mean, that was what, an hour? I mean, it wasn't long, was it?
You can't compare everything to OJ, but yeah.
I compare everything to OJ. I really do. Okay.
Don't spoil it for me. I don't know what happened.
After the trial, Evans barrister Michael Eddowes wrote a book called "The Man on Your Conscience." Basically arguing that Evans was innocent and that Christie was guilty. Okay, this is a really interesting side note.
What?
Barrister means lawyer, man.
Yeah,
I got that because of the bar and everything.
Have you
else,
seen
yeah.
A Fish Called Wanda? Okay, just checking.
Yeah, so basically he wrote a book saying that his client for the defense was innocent and that Christie did it. As an interesting side note, Eddowes, the barrister, was then later in years became part of the Profumo scandal, which you guys probably haven't heard of, but it was basically this big scandal where government ministers were caught with sort of Russian spy hookers, and it was all.
Wait, is that from the great Billy Joel song "We Didn't Start the Fire" when he says British politician sex?
Yes.
Oh my God, I finally know what that's about.
You could have asked me that years ago. Bravo. Finally, Vok is for something.
Blown away. What else do I
have? Yeah, but exactly. Okay, so this is going to blow your mind. Let me read this whole sentence. As an interesting side note. Oh, no, it's going to get more blown. If you think
I'm
of
how. I'm happy now that we just got an answer to the great, you know, we didn't start the fire reference. So anything after this is.
Okay, so what. After the British politician sex, it goes on to JFK blown away. This is why your mind's going to be blown.
No, don't blow my mind. Okay, go ahead.
Do you want to take a drink first? Because you really are going to be in shock when you hear this.
I have to think of putting
the drink. Is it going to be like a spit take kind of shock? Or
I'm trying to honestly think of the order now because British politician sex, JFK blown away. What else do I have to say, right? That's the order, right?
Okay, so as an interesting side note, Eddowes was then part of the Profumo scandal and also was the man who originated the conspiracy theory that a Soviet doppelganger for Oswald killed JFK based on the differing heights of the Oswald corpse and photos of Oswald pre-assassination.
Mind
blown. What? So Wait a minute. Why is he making things about the JFK assassination?
So Billy Joel obviously knew about Michael Eddowes.
I've just been reciting "We Didn't Start the Fire" in my head for the last 30 seconds, so I didn't hear anything you said.
So
you mean I have to say this again for like the 10th time?
No. I heard it. Don't worry.
Okay, cool. I'm going to move on now.
Wait a minute.
We don't need another JFK conspiracy. We have enough.
Yeah. What is crazy. He doing? He's been talking about it. Is this guy like Trump? He's just like, I think something. I'll tweet it out and send it out into the universe.
Stop making everything so political, man.
I don't know.
Okay, anyway. So back to the case. Meanwhile, the Home Secretary, who's our... What's that the equivalent to for you guys? It's your person who's in charge of Department of Justice, I guess?
Yeah.
Okay.
Beauregard Sessions. Yeah, him.
Yeah. Okay. So
he just fired 46 people.
Yeah, that guy.
Okay. Just so you know, pretty much every president does that. I did look into it. It's not that bad. It is better.
Yeah, but they fired the guy Barada from New York City, who this is our guy.
Yeah, I know it sucks, but it's not like a coup yet. I mean, it's been a coup the whole time, but cut this out, Bina.
Okay. Meanwhile, the Home Secretary ordered the case to be reinvestigated by a barrister called John Scott Henderson, QC. He interviewed many witnesses, including Christie, once again, and concluded that Evans was guilty and that Christie had only confessed before... Anyway, basically. Basically, there was an investigation and Evans is seen to be guilty. Okay, I'm going to reorder some stuff and then come back to it.
Wait a minute. So even though they suspect Christie, they now think Evans is guilty and it's been published and no one gives a shit?
Yeah, he's dead. It's 1950. He's dead.
Right.
There's a perfunctory government inquiry, but basically they stick to the story that Evans is dead.
They're like, we got it wrong, but...
No. We got it right and he's dead and this is good. Right. Okay. After the trial...
And also a doppelganger killed JFK.
Yeah, which is like a,
all likely things.
Exactly. Okay, so after the trial, Christie got a series of other jobs because basically he lost his job as a post office guy because of the criminal record coming out. So, he's getting like odd jobs as being a clerk or a driver. He actually became quite involved in union politics and he became a union rep, but he continued living at Rillington Place with his wife, Ethel.
You keep mentioning this address and I just assume that it's much more important in England than it is that I know about.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't even know. Besides the fact that no one can take a shit in their own apartment. I don't know
what's going
on in this place. And like the graveyard in the backyard.
Like where the Muffin Man lives on Mulberry Lane. Like these two are in the same class.
Exactly.
It has a white picket fence of like rib cages or something. But
it's the Bone Garden. We've been over this. It's his Bone Garden.
The house changed owners and was sublet to a West Indian man who in turn rented it out room by room. Christie was then exposed as a massive racist who hated this man and the new tenants basically because they were black. He tried to complain to the council and they inspected the rooms but didn't find in Christie's favour. The alleged bad neighbours and the stress of the Evans trial led to Christie's genuine ill health. He's suffering from insomnia, he's sobbing, he has headaches, he's giddy. In 1952, he was off work for...
Giddy?
Like
two of those go, and then one of them, like, which symptom doesn't fit?
Ah, my shit, fucking...
I'm shitting my pants.
Shitting my pants. But boy, yeah. Everything is looking up.
In 1952, he was off work for 8 months and may well have had some kind of nervous breakdown. His wife, Ethel, was also prescribed sleeping tablets and had a nervous skin condition. Meanwhile, Christie...
What is that? What does that mean? What's a nervous skin condition?
It means you get...
Psoriasis.
Their skin was like, I just can't do it.
Okay, meanwhile, Christie had apparently taken up photography and would hang out in cafes and bars in the area, buying drinks for young girls and offering to take their photographs. Sometimes he'd invite them back to his flat, but with his wife there, he was constrained in what he could do. So,
you know what? The wife is really a buzzkill. I've learned that.
Did he forget? Like, oh shit, that's right, my wife is there. I can't murder or take your picture right now. Sorry.
So, eventually, on December 14th, 1952, aged 53, Christie strangled his wife, Ethel, while she slept.
You're such a buzzkill.
He wrapped her in a blanket and buried her under the floorboards of the house.
The floorboards. I'll bury her next to the shitter.
In his confession, he claims it was a spontaneous mercy killing because she was so neurotic and on edge about the black neighbors. So he basically...
What year are we at right now?
1952. He's claiming...
They have a bathroom, right?
No, they don't have a bathroom.
England, come on. Get your shit together, no pun intended.
He's claiming that he killed her to save her from the black neighbours who were causing her a nervous breakdown. But it was, in fact, a premeditated murder because the day before, he'd written a letter to her family saying that his wife couldn't write because she had rheumatoid arthritis in her hands and couldn't hold the pen, but not to worry because he was taking care of her.
Did he say he has a very bad case of care of her?
Yeah.
So Ethel,
don't worry, she'll feel nothing soon.
So Ethel, the wife, was the only one of his victims that he didn't gasp before her death, apart from the first one who was spontaneous. So she would definitely have known what he was doing when he was killing her, because she hadn't had that many sleeping pills. After the murder, Christy told the neighbors she'd gone back north to her family, and he told her family that she'd left him. So he was trying to throw everyone off the trail. Desperate for money because he's not really working now, he sold her clothes, pawned her wedding ring, forged her signature, and emptied her bank account within a matter of days. So this is December 14th, 1952. He's now got the flat for himself. And so the January and February of 1943, he goes on a killing spree and kills three women. So the first was a 25-year-old called Rita Nelson. She was killed on the 19th of January, 1953. And again, a very unfortunate case. She'd left school at 14, entered into a life of petty crime. She'd had convictions for drunkenness and prostitution. She'd been in a mental institution. She eventually came to London looking for work and to visit her sister who lived in Ladbroke Grove, which is kind of next to Notting Hill. She started working as a prostitute again and was pregnant probably at the time of her murder, although that's not confirmed.
This was not the Rita that the Beatles wrote the song about.
No.
It may have been. Never know.
No, it's not. The second victim was called Kathleen Maloney. She was 26 years old and was killed sometime in February. Kathleen was born in Plymouth, which is the coastal town in England, but was soon orphaned. She was raised in a succession of girls' homes and convents. Eventually, she ran away to London, where she began working as a prostitute, plying her trade with American soldiers in Paddington. She'd done several stints in prison for drunkenness and prostitution, but by the time Christy met her, she was homeless. He lured her in by promising her some of his wife's clothes and a place to stay. No one reported her missing after her death.
Wait a minute, so he kept some of his wife's clothes, or he sold them all?
No, he sold them, but he just like was promising. Like, he would literally cruise the cafes and try and get sympathy from girls by saying, oh, my wife has died, I'm so upset. And like coming across as like a really harmless old man. And oh, you're so unfortunate, do you need a place to stay? Are you hungry? Come along home and I'll give you...
And how old is he? He's in his like 60s at this point?
He's mid-50s and these girls are in their 20s.
Yeah, he was born 1899, Greg. Remember from when she shouted it? God damn it. Pay attention.
And, you know, like, he looks fairly harmless. Anyway. He's kind of, you know, skinny and looks weak, and he has a soft voice. So I think he looks fairly harmless.
So he looks English? Hey!
Ba-dum-tsh. The final victim was Hectorina McLennan. She was aged 26 and was killed on March the 6th, 1953. She was a young girl from Glasgow, Scotland. She'd already had two illegitimate children by the time she'd come to London, the latter by a Burmese Air Force man who she'd hoped to marry, but he left and went back to Burma in 1951. There's no evidence that she was a prostitute. So a lot of times you read reports that Christy only killed prostitutes. That's not true. She lived with her entire family in London, but her parents and children returned to Scotland, leaving her to live with her brother. She started seeing a married man called Baker shortly before her murder, and also had told her Methodist priest she was pregnant, but no one thinks she was. But they were living a really hand-to-mouth existence, moving from address to address. And Christy basically lured them in by saying that he'd give them a place to stay. And he actually did. So both Hectorina and her boyfriend were living with him. When he went out, she was murdered. So this is how he did the last three murders. Oh. All three suffered carbon monoxide poisoning in the kitchen and were then strangled. Christy then raped them repeatedly as they died. He would wrap their bodies, including cloths between their legs, because he didn't like the bodily fluids coming out after he killed them. Like, so he made them kind of almost like diapers. And then these three women he buried in a kitchen alcove, so a small sort of recessed bit of the wall in the kitchen, which was incredibly small, so he bound them together to fit them in, and then wallpapered over it.
So the murder garden was...
What is going on with English architecture? A kitchen alcove that you can bury bodies in? Floorboards that can be, like, brought up?
You can only fit so many people in a murder garden, Matt. How many do you not have a murder garden?
Like, in classic Victorian sense, this odd kitchen alcove can fit four bodies. And the floorboards you'll find will come up quite easily.
Okay, so the exception to this modus operandi was the death of, or the murder of Hectorina. Realizing that her boyfriend could come back at any time, Christy was evidently under time pressure, so he didn't have time to wrap her up and put her in the alcove naked. When the police eventually found these bodies, they also found a tin, like an empty candy tin, pastel tin, that contained pubic hair from four women, one of which does not match any of the known victims. He claimed...
Go ahead, Matt. Make a joke about women's pubic hair on a tin. I'll leave this one to you.
What, man?
That's really mean. That's mean.
Yeah.
Anyway, Christy claimed that the pubic hair was from the three last victims and his wife, but The other key question is how exactly he really did kill these people with gas, because apart from the one where he kind of put the gas through the tubes and kind of fragranced it, his modus operandi for these last three was basically to have the gas pipe in the kitchen with a bulldog clip over it, and then he would take the clip off and the gas would come out of the pipe. But he claims in his confessions that he used to sit in the kitchen with them and see them pass out. But how did he not pass out from the gas?
Well, that was my question. He's not like, he doesn't have obviously some like gas mask or anything, but he's not holding a tube in their face or something like that?
No. So this is something that was raised. No. This is something that
Mustard gas brought out his mutation, which is to be able to breathe in any sort of air. So
he's a mutant now?
Yeah, you know, I'm rolling off of Logan still, so that's my theory.
Yeah, but anyway, this was brought up at the trial successive times, and a lot of the sort of government scientists were like, they just can't understand. It's kind of interesting because it's a really famous case of a serial killer, but still I think there's a central mystery about how he did actually gas them, and did he somehow leave the room, or what, you know, what was going on? Anyway, so he's killed his wife, he's very quickly killed these three young women and buried them in the alcove in the kitchen. Now, this is the bit that, again, is very, very odd. If you'd buried all these women in your house, presumably you would not want to leave your house so that anyone else might find them. But a mere 2 weeks later, Christy moves out of his flat and sublets it to another tenant. And actually, he was caught by his landlord that very night and evicted.
What was the address of that flat?
All together now.
I just want to give props to the landlords of England, who are like the heroes of his story.
They're the only ones who actually give a shit, right?
Yeah.
Oh, no, they're not the heroes. They're fucking charging people rent so they can go outside.
Yeah, but they're actually the ones reporting the crimes. They're reporting the crimes.
So basically, they're the slum landlords, but, you know, money's a powerful motive. So basically,
like, our kitchen alcoves can hold 6 bodies, but you have the poop outside.
So basically, Christy finds himself evicted from his flat. The next tenant is a West Indian man. He tries to put up some shelves in the kitchen to hold a transistor radio. And when he goes to put the shelves up, realizes that the alcove is not stable, takes off the wallpaper, sees the dead bodies, and calls the police. It's now the 24th of March.
How did they not smell it? What is going on?
She did like, say that did he dip them in the bodies. He cleaned the bodies.
He also would get found by. He also used to get found by his fellow tenants using. I don't know if you've heard of something called Jay's fluid. It's a kind of bleach, like, you know, your domestic bleach that we'd use to kind of dilute it to mop floors or whatever. And he would use it neat and be always like mopping the floors and stuff. So this very powerful cleaning fluid smell would be every morning in the house.
Because they had a stink, right? I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
So anyway, meanwhile, so now the police know that there are bodies in the flat, if not in the garden, and they found the three in the alcove, they found the tin of pubic hair, they found the woman under the floorboards, and they know it's Christie's flat.
They found out that ribcage fences aren't a thing.
Yeah, so they are now looking for Christie. Christie, meanwhile, wanders up to King's Cross, which is central London, but a bit north near the train station. He checks into a B&B under his own name and giving his own address.
He gives that's zero fuck.
That's how they catch you. I've learned that from documentaries. You accidentally sign your own name.
Well, I think it was even accidental. And I think that's another key thing is why does he sublet the flat? Why does he give up the flat? And why does he then make it so easy for the police to catch him? He spends his days wandering the streets of London. He's still cruising cafes, offering to take girls' photos and help them out of unwanted pregnancies. But he is picked up by police on Putney Bridge on March 31st, so a week later. When tested, he still had semen on his clothes and shoes, suggesting that these were the clothes he'd killed his last victim in.
Or just jerked off in.
Well, yeah. Oh, so now jerking off is what makes you squeamish on this whole call?
Wait a minute, Matt. I'm sorry. Do you get semen on your clothes and shoes when you jerk off?
I don't get semen on my clothes and shoes when I have sex, so I don't understand the question.
Me neither.
Okay. So, Christy has
I guess if you do it right.
Or wrong.
It might happen.
Christy has now been arrested, so he's in police custody. While in police custody, he confesses to killing 7 women, including Beryl Evans, who's, remember, the wife of the guy who hung, killing her. But he denies killing the baby Geraldine Evans. But his confessions are really slippery. He mixes up motives and times, claims women were coming onto him rather than him luring them in. yeah, it's really like he'll say, well, you know, she kind of was calling at me over the street rather than, yeah, I went to a cafe and like invited her back. So it's a bit.
He's using the she was asking for it defense.
Yeah, basically. And it's a bit H.H. Holmes-ish. Like, he's very slippery. At what point he claimed he hadn't.
Was he a star? Like, because when you're a star, they let you do anything. You grab him by the you know whats.
Exactly. At one point, he claimed he hadn't had sex with Beryl because of his back problems. And then he said he had. So he just changed his story.
He blamed it on his back?
Yep.
Old limp dick Reggie blamed it on his back?
Yes. He claimed the pubic hair was from his wife and the three final victims, but claimed he couldn't remember how he got it.
Oh God, that's a tough one to walk out of.
In order to verify Christie's confession, the bodies of Beryl and Geraldine were exhumed. He'd claimed that he'd gassed Beryl when he'd killed her, but there was no evidence of carbon monoxide poisoning on her body. But
how can they tell?
Because you go pink if you have carbon monoxide poisoning.
But she's been dead for years, yes? No?
Well, 3 years, but no, that you would have been able to tell. The other thing is that although he said that he killed her, he didn't describe anything or explain anything about the bruising on her face, which would be consistent with the husband killing her after a violent fight.
Well, no, that was him testing out his punching, air punching, and she got in the way.
Well, there you go. Christie was also examined by various psychiatrists, some of whom declared he was sane, some declared he was insane. He exhibited no empathy for the dead, or rather that he could have no empathy as he couldn't remember the murders. He only cried while recalling his wife. But how far was his amnesia, the actual amnesia he'd been diagnosed with prior to the murders in the 1950s, and how far was he deliberately feigning loss of memory to bolster his insanity plea?
So he is using the insanity plea as a defense at this point?
Yeah, so here we go. The trial...
Was that an established thing in England at this point? Because I know in America it wasn't.
So basically, ever since, as you'll remember from your Jack the Ripper podcast, there was something called the McNaghten defense, which was basically established in the late 1800s. And that was, you could...
Yeah, Greg, tell us about it.
You could enter the insane plea if you can prove that you didn't know what you were doing and that you didn't know that it was wrong. So he has to kind of establish that he's foggy and he doesn't know what he did and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's a genuine way of getting off the charge. So the trial of John Christie began on June 22nd, 1953 to huge press and public interest in sharp contrast to Evans' trial. In fact, a national newspaper paid for his defense in exchange for an interview. So it's a little bit H.H. Holmes-ish.
Yeah, I remember that from H.H. Holmes. They would just interview him and pay him for that.
Yeah, exactly. At the trial, Christie was only actually charged with killing his wife. So Evans was charged with killing his daughter. Christie was charged with killing his wife. So no one's actually ever been charged with killing Beryl Evans, which I kind of find sad. Like, she never got justice. He gave evidence in
Didn't she also, like, lose a child and, like, all sorts of other shit?
Oh, yeah, 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 but I mean...
Well, Stephen King did write a book under her name, so evensies? I don't know.
Anyways, ha ha ha. Christie gave evidence in his defense for 3 hours, but claimed substantial loss of memory and was contradictory. So this is an interesting...
How do you not remember something for 3 fucking hours?
Yeah, he would say stuff...
You're like, what, did you do this? I don't know.
It's really interesting, like, if you go and read the transcripts of what he said, it's stuff like... Well, you know, I can't remember if I had sex with Ruth. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. I just can't recall at this point. It's all very foggy. I'm sure if you say I killed 7 women, I probably did. And then at times he talks about killing 12 women. It's just very odd.
So he's like tacitly admitting, is like, oh, I suppose I did.
Well, he kind of wants to make it feel like he did more because he thinks the more he claims to have killed, the more insane people will think he is. So Dr. Hobson for the defense said, and I quote, this is a psychiatrist, I feel that throughout he has been unable to remember things. He has falsely remembered things. I feel that most of the time this falsification of memory or this forgetting resulted from this hysteria, from this disease of the mind. I think that most of the time he did indeed forget and did not know that there was some purpose in his forgetting. At other times, of course, he has also lied. So there's a sense in which his lack, like not remembering is a way of him allowing himself to carry on and like not have empathy. But how far is it deliberate and how far is it a defense, psychological defense mechanism, and how far is he doing it just to get, you know, get off the crime? So there are big questions here.
Well, he is crafty. He did leave school when he was 14.
Yeah, although that was normal in that period, though. But I feel that I still, to this day, I don't really understand who killed Beryl Evans, whether it was her husband or whether it was him. I don't understand how he gassed the victims while not being gassed. And I genuinely don't know whether he was genuinely insane. Like, was
but isn't it accepted that the husband was falsely convicted of killing her?
We're getting into it. No, I mean, that would be the mainstream view, but I don't think it's utterly heterodox to think the opposite. So, The trial is over. The jury deliberated just 85 minutes, during which Christie asked for an update on the test match cricket scores. Priorities. He was found sane and therefore guilty. He did not appeal, and he was hanged by the same man who hanged Evans, a very famous hangman in England called Alfred Pierpoint, at 9 a.m. on July 15th, 1953. He was the last serial killer to be hanged in Great Britain.
I was going to say, at what point did they stop having a guy hang serial killers in England? But I guess it was 1953.
Yeah, maybe Alfred needs to be looked into there.
There's actually a very brilliant movie about Pierpoint called Pierpoint, where he's played by Timothy Spall. And he's such a fascinating character. He also was the guy who was sent from England to do the Nuremberg trial hangings. So he had a really fascinating career. So he
was like the guy in Blazing Saddles who reprised his role in like Robin Hood Men in Tights. He's just like the professional hangman.
Yep.
Gotcha.
Okay, so Christie is tried in the same courtroom as Evans. He's buried inside the same prison as Evans had been. The public are allowed to attend the inquest. 200 to 300 people turn up. They're booing and hissing. Rillington Place was already a tourist attraction with people gathering outside to take photographs. And Madame Tussauds, the waxwork museum, already had a waxwork of Christie on display. So it's like a massive... It's like the O.J. Simpson trial of its day, where it's a huge public big deal.
Yeah, I'm gathering that, yeah.
Yeah, seriously, how morbid are you English? Like, you're like, let's go watch this guy die. Now, then let's go get our picture taken with his wax figure.
So part of the reason why I think this case is interesting is, A, because I think it is kind of ambiguous as to who did it, but also because this all happened at a time when people were starting to agitate for an end to the death penalty. So it became a huge kind of cause célèbre. So basically, there was an inquest on the victims that was completed in 1953. The final resting place of Ruth First, a mural Edie, is actually still unknown. I was trying to like track it down, see where these women were buried. Rita Nelson, Kathleen Maloney are buried in unmarked graves in Gunnersbury Cemetery in Kensington. And Hectorina MacDonald has a marked grave there, if anyone wants to go visit and pay respects. And
how do they know that they're buried there?
No, their remains were buried there after the inquest. Mm. And I can't find out where...
What's holding up the fence?
Yeah, I can't find out where the wife was buried. So anyway, this was a huge thing. So immediately after the trial of Evans, there was this very sort of quick and perfunctory government investigation by the government of the day that sort of came down on the side that basically they'd got it right that Evans had killed his wife and justice had been served. The rumblings carried on, and then in 1961, a very famous investigative campaigning journalist who specialised in agitating about sort of cases of injustice called Ludovic Kennedy, he wrote a book called 10 Rillington Place, which is why the address is really famous. And this became a huge bestseller. And basically, he was using the case to prove that the death penalty was unjust and could get things wrong. So he basically painted the idea that Evans was this very weak man, very psychologically sort of fragile, and that Christie had been this master manipulator, and that he'd offered to do an abortion on the wife, had deliberately killed her, and then had sort of blackmailed Evans into saying, well, you know, if the police come here, they'll do you for, you know, the planned abortion, so let's just hide the body, and that Christie had also killed the child. So basically this was a total defense of Evans. And that's why I think what Greg said, well, the mainstream accepted view is that Christie did it, because I think that was, the book was so popular. So a second inquiry was ordered by the High Court judge Sir Daniel Brabin in 1965. Now, this is the truly fair, impartial High Court inquiry, and it took a long time, and he interviewed everybody. And he concluded...
More than 85 minutes?
Yeah, exactly. He concluded... Actually, is Greg back? We should wait for him for this bit, because this is like the punchline.
Oh, he posted Charlie Choo Choo. That looks fucking terrifying.
I'm back. I'm sorry. I had to break the seal.
That looks fucking terrifying.
Right?
It's a children's book. Of course it's terrifying.
That looks absolutely petrifying.
Okay. It looks like a clappy much.
Okay, so basically there's a big campaign to free Evans. Ludovic Kennedy, a campaigning journalist, wrote a book in 1961 called 10 Rillington Place, Greg, which is why everyone thinks that Christie did it and Evans didn't, because that's the kind of, that's the on-the-record history. It's like Shakespeare wrote the history of Tudor England and everyone thinks that's what happened. So the High Court judge, Sir Daniel Brabourne, concludes that Evans probably did kill his wife, that it probably was a sort of a jealous argument over debt that went wrong, but that a jury probably shouldn't have convicted him on the evidence it was presented, and therefore it was a miscarriage of justice, even though he was guilty. He also concluded that Christie probably killed the baby Geraldine, and therefore, because the trial was for killing the baby, Evans also should have been acquitted because he didn't actually kill the baby. So Evans is guilty, but not of what was before the trial, so it was a miscarriage of justice, but not in the way that people think it is, that, oh, well, Christie did it all and manipulated Evans. The surrounding
maybe the dingo killed the baby.
Exactly. The dingo killed my baby. The surrounding controversy led to the abolition of the death penalty in Great Britain in 1965 and the posthumous pardon of Evans in 1966. So this is the case that basically ended the death penalty.
So you had a serial killer end your death penalty. That's fucking bonkers.
They're like, oh, we fucked up and killed the wrong person, so we should end it forever.
So he gets the pardon in 1966. In 1971, the very famous and popular book, 10 Rillington Place, is made into a film starring Richard Attenborough as Christie and John Hurt as Evans, and is today seen as, you know, it's like a really iconic movie. Everyone in England's watched it, and it's really powerful, but I think that is the reason why everyone thinks that Evans was utterly innocent, and I don't think he was utterly innocent. Christie is evidently a very sick and sad man, but
what do you think that Evans actually did?
I think that Evans killed his wife in a domestic argument, but that Christie killed the baby. He turned to Christie for help, and that Christie told him not to go to the police.
Do you think Christie was involved in that or no?
No.
Okay, so that's just an awful coincidence of two murderers coming together.
And that's the thing, like, can you have two people who kill people in the same house? I'm like, well, in a slum part of London, probably.
I'm sure you can, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. and the fact that she wasn't sexually interfered with. I mean, if you look at the way Christie plans his murders, he uses gas. Wasn't the case with her.
No, that makes sense. I mean, it seems to make sense that it would have been evidence of that.
So Ludovic Kennedy in his famous book claimed that the forensic pathologist didn't take a sample from her vagina, but the forensic pathologist said, yes, I did, and there wasn't semen on it. Stop lying. So, you know. The point is that the book and the movie that everyone judges this case on, because it's the Richard Attenborough, John Hurt movie, is probably, you know, Ludovic Kennedy was using it to prove a point and to get rid of the death penalty. He wasn't actually interested in that specific case. He was making a political point. And he won. He did get rid of the death penalty. But that's not necessarily what happened. I think you just can't know. So I'm going to go with a high court judge who says the balance of evidence is probably that Evans did the wife, that Christie did the baby, but there's actually not enough evidence either way to convict either of them.
And wasn't the baby in the wife?
No, that, well, there's a child called Geraldine and there's an unborn baby. So there's, yeah, so there's two murders. There's the murder of the wife, which then therefore kills the unborn baby, but they're separately the murder of the baby.
We'll call it a fetus because you can't call it an unborn baby.
Yeah, exactly.
Or else it's a person and it's political. Murder and you can get abortions.
Yeah, I know. So basically,
to the end where we get to sing We Didn't Start the Fire? I'm just waiting for that.
We're nearly at the end. So basically, okay. That film becomes hugely popular. My point is that I think there were not one but two miscarriages of justice per British law. Evans was convicted.
And maybe one natural miscarriage. Who knows?
Well, and So Evans was convicted of killing his child, Geraldine, which I don't think he did. And I don't think there was the evidence to convict him for that. So he definitely should have been pardoned for that, even though he was guilty of other stuff. But Christie was convicted. Well, he was convicted of killing his wife, which he did do, which I think is fine. But I think he also gets the blame for killing Beryl, which I don't think he did. But he did kill lots of other people, so maybe that's okay. Interestingly,
yeah, it's kind of weird. It's like this is the vindication of a serial killer for the one thing that he didn't do.
Yeah, exactly. So in 2003, Evans's sister and half-sister were given ex gratia payments by the British government as compensation for the miscarriage of justice. So the wheels of justice in Britain work slowly, but they work.
You can't do that
through
in America, I don't think.
The Crown apologizes to the family for fucking up.
I think a guy just got like 175 grand for being falsely imprisoned for like 25 years. That was like his, like, oh, sorry, we fucked up.
Yeah, we do that all the time. Like, if we've taken away years of your life and that's been proven to be wrong, the British Crown deserves, I mean, you must be able to sue the British Crown for that, right?
You'd think.
Anywho, the case continues to be incredibly well known of in Britain. There's lots of books about it. It's kind of as it's the sort of contemporary version of Jack the Ripper, and I think it fascinates people partly because he was burying bodies in the house, which is also always interesting, but partly because if you believe he did it all and manipulated Evans, not only is he a dastardly serial killer for killing all these people, but he's doubly evil because he convicted the guy who he framed on his own evidence. Yeah,
he's like a criminal mastermind.
Yeah, he's a criminal mastermind. And also because it just shows the British police to be hopeless or for no one for doing a criminal record check. So in 2016, if you're interested, the BBC made a really good mini-series called Rillington Place, which again...
Here's that address again.
Yeah, and basically it starred Tim Roth as Christie and Samantha Morton and as his wife. And why that series was really interesting, I think, is it basically implies that the wife knew about the murders but was so scared of him that she wouldn't go to the cops, and that when he kills her it's because she's going to sort of turn him in. So it really gets into the psychology of the marriage. Yeah. So it's speculation, but I think it's very well done. But again, I have seen it and I would recommend it.
Yeah. No, I love Tim Roth and I'll watch anything he does. So.
I mean, the original film with John Hurt, I mean, it's absolutely spectacular. But it goes to prove that from 1971 to 2016, all the major media portrayals are that Christie did everything. And that Evans is this feeble-minded, simple-minded fool who was manipulated. And I'm just not sure that the evidence is there for him killing Beryl. Maybe he did. I just don't think there's the evidence there. So, And I think it's just as simple as most people can't wrap their head around the fact that maybe there were two murderers living in the same house.
So it's easier to blame, you know, one guy for everything, especially if he was a serial killer for other things.
So yeah, so that's the story of John Reginald Halliday Christie. I'm not sure if that was suitable for dolloping, but it was just too long for a like 10-minute round table.
Yeah.
Either way, it's hilarious. Hilarious.
So there you go. And you've learned something about one of the most famous serial killers in England. I mean, if you like Google lists of most famous British serial killers, there's like the Yorkshire Ripper, Jack the Ripper, the West.
I don't know what's the Yorkshire Ripper. Why don't I know this?
The Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, killed prostitutes. They all kill prostitutes, don't they?
It's kind of fucking sad.
It is, and actually reading about these girls was kind of sad to me because they kind of reminded me of the Black Dahlia insofar as, you know, Elizabeth Short, no family, no real friends, drifting hand-to-mouth existent, checking in and out of 14 addresses in 4 years, no one really to check up after her, kind of drifts maybe into prostitution, maybe not. But, you know, like these girls on the edge of society who are just so vulnerable. And it's a consistent story from the time of Jack the Ripper through to this story, through to Elizabeth Short.
And every time it's almost like, well, it's their fault. Like they could have done something, but it's like, no, society didn't like let them.
You know, and if some kind of nice, avuncular looking 50-year-old who looks very like harmless is offering you shelter and a place to stay. I mean, admittedly, he was using some as prostitutes, but, and you're desperate and you're literally homeless, as in the case of the first one, Ruth First, then my goodness, you go for it. So yeah, it's just horrific. And you just think if John Christie hadn't given up the lease on his flat, how many more women would he have killed? And truly, how many women did he kill? Because maybe not all of them.
I mean, that's kind of like an accepted thing within within murder and crime in general, that whatever you admit to, there's much more going on than what you admit to, what you're actually convicted of. Like
that's what happened with H.H. Holmes. The law could only prove that he had killed X amount of people, but he's like, nah, man, way more than that. And I think that's the same with a lot of serial killers. Well, we can only prove that he killed 10 people, but meanwhile, like, he's tied to, like, you know, 30, 50, 100 additional missing persons.
He's basically, if you look at what's attributed to him, it's always 7 people, but a lot of times during the confessions when he was getting foggy and going in and out, he would talk about 12, like 12 gets mentioned by him a lot. So I do wonder whether there's an extra 5 victims out there.
Yeah, and especially, you know that he has the number.
Yeah, exactly. And especially during the war, because I feel that with the Blitz going on and being a policeman and being able to blackmail the prostitutes, I just feel that that would have been such a good opportunity for him. Yeah. So...
Or even just in the chaos, like not even using prostitutes, but like people that are looking for like a police officer for some kind of direction. And he's like, oh, don't worry. Like you can come stay at my place or, you know, it's something. Like, I don't think they are probably all prostitutes. I think that's where he felt comfortable going into, but...
The other thing is, like, what I find fascinating is, and we'll definitely never know this because there's just no written evidence or whatever, but I do find it so hard to believe that his wife didn't know about the first two murders and also about whatever happened with Geraldine and Beryl Evans. She must have known. How can a wife not know? And how far was she also just taking sleeping pills to deliberately block stuff out? Not being mentally
ill. And also, like, even his neighbors, like, they must have been like, you know, a don't give a fuck, like, you don't talk about me, I don't talk about you. Like, burying a body in the backyard, like, you can cover it up as much as you want, but it's still like, oh, someone dug a hole, you know, in the backyard. Like, they have to be like, oh, well, that's just normal.
But people are out at work during the day. So if he's, that's the kind of weird thing about his illnesses, that he was able to a lot of time off. They're working class people. They're all out at work. And then the other thing is, like, you'd find all these reports of the neighbor saying, oh, well, he was just very quiet, sort of kept to himself, always looked very professional. Yeah, just a very banal, boring guy, and they had, you know, better things to worry about. But there was the thing about, you know, why was he always using the Jay's fluid to clean the floors, and that everything was very locked. So, for instance, he always kept the door to the back garden locked, and so if you went to his house, you sort of, he would sort of lock the living room to go into the kitchen to make the cup of tea, and then, like, well, that's very unusual. And the neighbor saying, oh yes, we saw him carrying the wallpaper and stuff. And
well,
but no.
Because he knew that when dealing with human tissue, that you have to disinfect everything with either 70% ethanol or 10% bleach solution, and he was just good about that.
Because you're not a serial killer. That's fine.
Part of my job, Dick.
So what's
how you decontaminate things.
What's Y doing this evening? Has she gone to visit her family in Brighton?
No, she has a girls' night.
That's just,
we're about to buy a house. Saying. I haven't heard her.
It's just at home talking about serial killers, as one does.
But I mean, it sounds like you guys had never heard of this guy, which I find quite amazing because he's super
famous
in England. He, along with, or Evans, along with Derek Bentley, are the two big sort of miscarriages of justice in England that are seen as causing the end of the death penalty. Although, interestingly, if you poll British people consistently since then to today, a majority would bring back hanging.
You see, I don't think hanging is okay. I think killing someone, like, outright, like, I'd prefer, like, a shooting squad than, like, a slow, like, lethal injection or electrocution or hanging.
See, I get that, but then you have to, like, take into fact that, like, someone on that shooting squad is actually killing someone, and that can fuck with them, too.
Well, I mean,
and
that's
super quick, though. I mean, Pierpoint said that he killed Christie in the time it took to flick cigar ash.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm against the death penalty anyway, because I don't think the government should be, you know, involved in killing their own citizens.
Yeah.
But I do acknowledge the fact that there are heinous fucking crimes that people deserve to be punished with. And, you know, sometimes there's no punishment that equals a crime, but death.
When the Death Penalty Act came into force in 1965, certain categories were kept on the books, so you could still be killed for treason. Espionage. And it was only when Britain kind of became part of, well, we'd been part of the European Union, but they kind of created European Union law that superseded ours, that in 1998, that was kind of made impossible. But now that we're Brexiting the EU, it'll be interesting to
see. Fucking hang them high.
Yeah,
right?
It'll be interesting to see if we withdraw that, because that cap on our justice system is gone. So, you know.
Remember, you hung a pheasant, but you hanged a peasant.
Exactly. Good to know. But yeah, so that was our last serial killer who was hanged. But just really, if you watch the film,
Noah.
I mean, Lord Richard Attenborough, Dickie Attenborough, when he, because it's a black and white film, when he plays Christie, and he has this, like, creepy, whispering, post-mustard gas voice, is very, that's one of the creepiest, most horrific things I've seen on screen. I mean, it's not a horror movie insofar as it's not, like, rated R or anything for being that scary, but it's really sinister. So
Bina, you don't have, like, more than individual states or municipalities that still have a death penalty. It's completely outlawed in the whole country.
So yeah, basically we have Scottish law is slightly different to English law.
Well, I assume they're killing everybody, you know. They're like,
but no, the death penalty applies everywhere. Actually, interestingly, when that Act of Parliament was applied, it was applied just in Great Britain, but not Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland got rid of it a decade later, and I suspect that was partly to do with the Republican terrorism and wanting to keep it there.
Yeah, I can see that.
But yeah, basically, typically the law here is the law that's the same everywhere. But Northern Ireland isn't interesting exception, because it remains incredibly, like, far more religious and fervently religious than the rest of the United Kingdom. So I was really shocked when I went there on holiday last year to discover that in England, basically, and Scotland and Wales, every woman has a right to contraception. In fact, it's free on the National Health Service. Getting an abortion is not a politicized act. Everyone has a right to it. It's not a major big deal. But apparently in Northern Ireland, that's not the case. Apparently Northern Ireland is far more restrictive than Southern Ireland. And that horrified me, because I thought we had one set of laws for the whole country.
Aren't they very Catholic?
No, very Protestant and then very Catholic and hence the troubles, but majority very Protestant. But actually the ultra-Orthodox Protestants in Northern Ireland are as socially repressive, if not more so, than the Catholics. So
that's weird, because usually it's the Catholics are they're like, you know, getting guidance from the Pope that's like abortion's the worst thing ever, and it's like, no, okay.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, we don't
contraception
have,
is bad, like, oh,
we don't have laws that vary state by state. So I don't know what to do now for my sicko serial. A lot of people who want to sign up, so I think we're gonna have like 7 or 8 people. So
well, I'm going to do the Werewolf of Bedburg,
which will be a
quick 10-minute kind of story about him.
I mean, I can pick any number of the serial killers from Adelaide, obviously, in Australia, which is like the serial capital of the world.
Well, I mean, it's Australia. They're all criminals besides the Aborigines.
Adelaide!
Amber.
Thanks, Amber.
It always takes me a second to hit my mute button.
Thank you, Amber, for whatever we're thanking you for.
Shouting out Adelaide.
She just did the, instead of like,
Adelaide!
Yeah, that.
Wait, so we're not going to sing We Didn't Start the Fire? Is that not happening?
Do you know what hurts? Because I'll be like, JFK, run away, what else do I have to say?
I think it's brilliant that Billy Joel evidently had heard of Michael Eddowes and therefore associated the Profumo scandal with JFK conspiracies.
That is kind of freaking crazy.
Wasn't Eddowes one of the victims of the Ripper?
Yeah, Catherine Eddowes.
Like, do we know that that's actually a thing?
It's not an uncommon name.
Oh.
When I got into Billy Joel, like, I went through this song, and, like, yeah, I knew Richard Nixon and North Korea, but, like, I would, like, do research on, you know, who the hell Nasser was or Prokofiev, and this song was, like, a formative
Nasser?
Thing,
Egypt?
My history. Yeah, but still, I was, like, you know, 18.
But you didn't just Google British political scandal and come up with that?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I never knew that. Okay. Dacron? I didn't know what Dacron was, or... You know, I knew when the Brooklyn Dodgers won the World Series, but
Dacron,
I don't know. I don't remember.
Uh-huh. I think you should sing us "We Didn't Start the Fire."
I'm not going to sing the whole song. Sorry.
Evidently,
so
that's it.
Okay, so that's it. That closes the case on Reggie No Boner.
What do you think? Do you think he killed Beryl and Geraldine, or do you think Evans did?
Well, what are the chances of two murderers coming together and one doing one murder and one doing the other? That seems very rare, but I think in this case it might actually make sense.
Yeah, I think they probably tag-teamed it, like, and I think it was probably our buddy Reggie that was like, hey, this is a good idea, and talk fucking guy into it, right?
Some people just need a nudge.
The Welsh dude, what was his name, Evans? Like, he was not only, like, simple, but, like, you know, obviously abusive. So, I mean, how much goading did it have to take from Christy to be like, hey, this is your wife's fucking you over. Like, why don't we do this?
Mm.
You know, I think it's probably an easy sell for Christy.
Mm. What do you feel, Greg?
I think that we didn't start the fire, but it was always burning since the world's been turning.
Oh, interesting.
We didn't start it. Yeah. I know that's a very risque thing to say.
What would bring you to that conclusion?
I don't know. The Stormfront.
Ah.
That was the album.
JFK blown away.
What else do I have to say? I had to write a parody of that song for like my 11th grade histories. I was like, something about the Council of Trent. I just remember that's all I remember, but I used that as the model for it. But thank you, Bina, for taking us on this journey.
Well, yeah. I kind of regret. I'm not sure if it was like if it lent itself to the dollop style of fun, but
I don't think it did at all. Really, reading find something funny about.
Do you think we should post it as a VOC, or do you think it was just like we should just think we hung out together? Because it's not. It's kind of weird. People are going to think we're weird for trying to make it funny.
Well, I think if we posted it with a VOC, with us saying, like, listen, like, we were trying to just goof on this, but, like, we realize that it's serious, and, like, you know.
Of course it's serious, but, like, the dollop has done everything.
Dollop's done serial killers, right?
George Washington teeth to actual serial killers, so it's a... like I said, I think anything can be funny in the right context. And I think, you know, you preface it, but also it is supposed to be done in a funny way. And I like to think we try to do that.
Yeah. And not only that, but it's like, I didn't know about this killer. So it's also educational. Like, us making dick and semen jokes, like, in the middle of it isn't going to, like, stop someone who's listening to this from possibly learning something.
God forbid someone actually learns something listening to a Vogue.
Oh my God. Imagine if someone did. That's like Betsy DeVos is like, we're better than her.
Mm.
We start like educating people. Like, we've done more than our Secretary of Education in the United States.
Bringing it full circle, Matt. Way to go.
I hate our government right now, so happy to do it.
To the Vollop, an occasional sicko serial killer podcast in which I, being a 007, read a true story to my friends,
Varley
and Greg,
who have no idea what the topic is going to be about.
Boom.
Come on.
Come on, guys. I was supposed to say that with you. Sorry.
Yeah, you're meant to say it together.
Sorry.
Okay, ready? 1, 2, 3. Who have no idea,
what the topic is going to be.
God damn it.
We're not, there's no facial cues. I can't tell. You're a voice on
the phone. I said 1, 2, 3.
All right.
I didn't count a 3. God damn it.
You can't have 2 Garys in one Dave. This ain't going to work. All right. How about 3, 2, 1? 3, 2, 1. Who have no idea what the topic is going to be about.
This is going well.
Just fix it in post, Bina. Just mash them up together.